This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle, here with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how's it going today?
Good. All is well.
Excellent. And all right, we're just going to go through these questions. We want to get to as many as we can. So we'll just start right away. Dear Dr. Lyle, my brother's been diagnosed as OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. He's my best friend. We're super close. It comes as no surprise. He's not necessarily a neat freak, germaphobe, hyperachiever, but he always had a tendency to hang on to thoughts and guilt for far too long. Recently, an incident that occurred has caused extreme feelings of guilt that are totally unwarranted, but have led him down into a dark spiral of thinking. He's recovered, but now views his OCD as such a limiting disease. Perhaps I'm wrong, but it seems that, based on your perspective, you would see OCD more as a personality type and can be harnessed towards the good. If it was the person in the tribe who was constantly on guard about the worst case scenario, essentially. So how would you go about communicating that OCD might be beneficial if hammered properly rather than a lifelong crippling disease state?
Good thinking, good question, and an interesting problem. So this is a type of OCD in this case, that at least with the specific instance had to do with a bunch of rumination about doing something that was outside the group norms or could have been viewed that way and therefore caused in principle possibly rejection from the group, and therefore this individual overestimating that worst case scenario spent essentially had their guilt chip sound off. And what that guilt chip is simply a signaling device to tell the individual that they may be at a threat for being kicked out of the group, for being essentially too self-centered with respect to conflicts of interest between self and group. And so in this particular instance, the OCD is manifesting there. Who knows? It could manifest in similar types of things, you know, with this individual as time passes. Now, to think of this as a disease is kind of a weird way. That's really not the right label for something like this. And a lifelong crippling disease. I think of it more as an error tendency for this individual. So It's a characteristic error that they're likely to make. They're susceptible to making this mistake. It's not a crippling disease. Now, so can we do something about it? Of course we can. We have to sort of go at OCD in a way that the OCD is likely to calm down and yield a bit to the evidence. So what... OCD, just so that people know what this is, it's obsessive compulsive disorder. And what's interesting about it is when we back up for a moment, we have to realize that behavior is the derivative of thinking. So the compulsive part of this, any behaviors that are manifest that you observe, are nothing other than the manifestation of thinking. So obsessive compulsive disorder is actually really just about bizarre thinking. The fact that there are behaviors attached just means that there is additional, there's really a couple of things that can be taking place. The person is ruminating and cycling over and over again about a potential threat. That's the obsessive part. Now, that obsession may have a behavior that is logically related to reducing the anxiety of the implied threat. So, for example, if they're thinking about germs, they may wash their hands. Now, what takes place here is interesting, that the root of all of this is what we're going to call the obsession, which is a distorted view of the threat. The obsession is usually not, my friends in cognitive therapy would call it irrational. I would say, actually, it's totally rational. It's just simply miscalibrated. So the I don't see bizarre thinking on OCD people. I see completely rational thinking, except that it's as if they can't tell the difference between 10 and 1,000. In other words, they're doing addition, but they're making mistakes. The nervous system is simply overrating the possibility of some threat. Interestingly enough, they don't overrate the possibility of great success. They simply overrate the possibility of a disaster. And you can see that actually all human beings overestimate the possibility of disaster. That's the whole point to having a warning device like anxiety that tells you if you're starting to walk down an alley in San Francisco to cut off the trip around the block to get your car and you hear a little trash can lid rattle, you immediately assume the worst and have a lot of anxiety. So now what are the odds that, you know, a rabid skunk is about to race up your leg and bite you and kill you? Virtually zero. But it's just enough. That possibility that something like that could be happening is enough to cause you to have quite considerable anxiety. So is that a distortion of the threat? Of course it is. But is it useful and adaptive from an evolutionary point of view? Absolutely. So the OCD person is really no different. It's just a matter of degree. So with that in mind, we look at this and we see something else that will take place. So the OCD person will take action to try to do things to try to reduce the anxiety. Now, the actions that they take are very often completely rational or logically related to the threat, but they might not be. So the person might actually be doing some goofy little thing like touching their elbow 3 times after they shook somebody's hand to make sure that, you know, somehow that is makes them safe from the germ threat. What's going on there is operant conditioning, in my belief. So what I believe is taking place is they have done something like that for some reason at some point. Maybe they touched their elbow once after they shook somebody's hand. They were thinking about the germs. Then they kind of picked at their elbow or touched their elbow, and then what happened was the brain then over the next minute or so, it underwent a relief that the shaking of the hands did not break out in a flesh-eating bacteria in the next 5 minutes. And so they kind of settled down and they realized they survived it. And maybe they were in a position where they couldn't wash their hands at that point. So, but they had kind of touched their elbow for some reason. So a little tiny connection gets made between touching the elbow and the relief that takes place, or maybe they touch their elbow after, as their anxiety was naturally coming down because nothing terrible was happening, the terrible thing that they were in fact anticipating. And so in this way, we can now get that to happen again because the brain makes a connection that maybe that's related to us being safe, can be completely unconscious, and then the person could actually even notice the unconscious processes that are taking place, and now it becomes an active superstition. And so what we're seeing is that the natural reduction of anxiety after a threat has actually reared its head and then it passes, now can have some behavior that takes place afterwards that winds up accidentally becoming associated with the decay function of the anxiety. And at that point, you wind up with a compulsion. So the compulsion part can be essentially an accidental byproduct of the decay function of the anxiety starting to come down when the dire consequences don't actually happen. Now, so then you get a funny-looking thing where the person still has the underlying cognitive distortions that lead, you know, that are the obsessive part of this thing, and then they have some funny little compulsion that takes place as well. So now, what can we do about this? The compulsions themselves can be a pain in the neck. So, for example, very often the compulsions are logically related to the underlying threat. So it might be, for example, washing their hands. What the person has to do is they have to go through the process that any addict goes through, because in fact it winds up being essentially an addictive process. So the person is addicted to the decay of the anxiety that takes place post-threat and during and after some compulsive activity that is involved, like hand washing. So what they need to do is, instead, just like an addict has to put up with the anxious, disturbing tension of not smoking if they want to get rid of a cigarette habit, so does the OCD person have to brave the anxiety and disturbing alarm signals in the nervous system, and they need to grit their teeth and not follow through on the compulsive behavior. And discover that they get the decay function and anxiety anyway. Now, the problem is, of course, that once this is conditioned, then they will go through an extinction burst, as I've talked about elsewhere. But the same thing that happens with a cigarette smoker, if they stop smoking when they're getting the cravings, their cravings will go up for a period of time, that the nervous system will throw a tantrum as it essentially seeks the reward and works diligently to try to find that reward. And so the same thing will take place with an obsessive individual that has a compulsion attached to it, that they will be seeking that feeling of relief, and they will be determined to take those actions, because those actions can be an important part of the process of that decay function hustling itself along. And they can get a lot of anxiety if they don't get to do that thing. So the solution is to usually map it out with a therapist, usually of the cognitive behavioral variety, that maps these things out and grits your teeth and actually do exactly what the nervous system does not want to do. This is precisely analogous to addiction. The last thing the nervous system wants to do is give up drugs, alcohol, and cheesecake. Okay, that's not what it wants to do. It does not want to go against its anticipated pleasure, relief, etc. And it will resist it and fight it. In the same way, the OCD individual, instead of fighting the pleasure hit of the chocolate bar, and that anticipation, they are fighting the anxiety and warning device that says, no, we really need to wash our hands. We really need to wash our hands. And if we don't wash our hands, something dire is going to happen, and I can feel it. Okay, I'm having anxiety that is sending a warning, 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 warning. We must do this. And the anxiety can be unbelievably high. And the person, you know, may not be able to tolerate a cold turkey from the jump of doing this. So a skilled OCD practitioner will map this thing out, set these goals, send the person with homework, and then they have to face it. And if they do their homework diligently and they are determined to fight this thing, they can learn to brave their instincts that are telling them differently, and that anxiety can be whittled down to a fraction of where it is probably operating you know, at any given time. So that's how we do this, and it's not life crippling. It's just it's more of a pain in the neck for most people. Some people can get pretty severe, but it doesn't have to be any disaster. About half of all of my best friends in life have OCD. I think I counted at one point that of the 11 people closest to me, 5 of them have OCD. So this is not it's quite clear that this is not any.
Are you self-selecting for high conscientiousness? Very smart.
I don't know. It looks like random accident, bad luck, quite frankly. But all of these individuals are actually all very successful, competent people with good lives. So they're quirky and they're a pain in the neck and they're also funny. So, and love them all. But this is OCD. It's nothing to be, if it's really bad, it's very severe, then you definitely should seek help from a skilled practitioner. Here's what I would not recommend. I would not recommend people be taking meds for it. So it got out into the world in the last 15 years or so that the SSRIs were a good treatment for OCD, and that's apparently, you know, a well-respected treatment for OCD. I wouldn't do it. If anybody's leaning on you and your OCD or you've got a family member and somebody's leaning on them to use SSRIs for their OCD, my vote is absolutely not. And we do not don't monkey with brain chemistry in any unnatural way. I think that's almost always a loser. I'm not going to say 100% of the time, but I'm going to say, in my judgment, 99% of the time, ever monkeying with the neurochemistry of a human is the wrong move. You know, unnatural monkeying with the neurochemistry. So anyway, that's what I have to say about OCD, and there's plenty of possible help for this this young man's brother. All right.
Excellent. So I got a couple of questions for you. Number one, what is this? What does this have to do with Tourette's syndrome? Where people, I've had a few people who they go through what you've just described, where they feel almost like you have to sneeze, but they feel like they have to, you know, wiggle their shoulder up or strengthen their hand or clench their fist, and it's just kind of the same thing. Is that a completely different thing, or how is this related?
Yeah, I believe it is different. In other words, Tourette's is, I think it's a different level of neurological disturbance, and, you know, I think it's a different wiring problem than OCD.
Mm-hmm. It's not a personality characteristic.
Right. I mean, yeah, the OCD is a funny little quirk. And I believe it's at the root, for example, of eating disorders typically, or sometimes is, I didn't think it is essentially the fundamental root of anorexia nervosa. And I think it's very often, you know, related, obviously, to bulimia. And so I think that I believe that that anyway. So I think, but no, Tourette's it's his own creature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whole different thing.
Okay. And then the second question I had is regarding conscientiousness is I've heard you talk about in previous episodes about whether or not someone is a decent human being and whether they're just a fundamentally good person. And the question I have is that conscientiousness, or can someone be essentially a shitty person but just very conscientious?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the thing, this is useful to sort of dive a little bit deeper into what we mean by these personality characteristics. We use words to try to describe patterns of behavior, and we're trying to encapsulate behaviors that are similar and to try to essentially be thinking of them as being derived from some characteristic nature of neural circuits that is giving rise to that behavior pattern. So we say, well, that's flaky behavior, that's responsible behavior, That's heroic behavior, et cetera. So we can sort of, in a simple fashion, we could say, well, if we use the big five or plus IQs, we've got like half a dozen characteristics, we could assign bell curve scores, percentile scores to each individual, and have a pretty darn good sense of what that individual's like and what the major processes of their life are probably likely to look like. Okay? We'd be pretty good. Pretty darn good, actually, in many ways. However, when we try to use a word like, okay, what is conscientiousness and where does this all add up in the scheme of things? Let me start to describe things like, what do we call a person who, you know, is a Jeffrey Dahmer but is super meticulous about how it is that they set up their horrendous crimes? What do we call that? Okay. The what that is normally, see, Jeffrey Dahmer, I don't think we would call him a sociopath. He's actually, I don't know about Dahmer. Forget about Dahmer for a second. That is a really bizarre human that has something badly wrong with them. Now, if we looked at a sociopath, we could also look at a sociopath that I would say sociopathy, the best looking description for sociopathy would be low conscientiousness and disagreeable. So I would see that as a combination. And when people have seen that combination together, they didn't call it a combination because they weren't thinking of these elements. They just called it a sociopath. Okay. However, you could in principle see that someone could be very disagreeable and actually conscientious in the sense that they are meticulous in their planning. You're not going to find, I mean, yet you can't. You will find people like that, very disagreeable, very conscientious, and that could be an exceptionally good negotiator, lawyer. You know what I mean? Some pain in the neck, nitpicking rule person that is just hard to get along with, but is very fastidious, et cetera. So
yeah, the classroom hall monitors when we were growing up, right?
Yeah, right. So that. And that's certainly not low conscientiousness. But so where you see these things start crossing over in what it is that you want to call it, because low conscientiousness, you could have someone who is, for example, high agreeable, but low conscientiousness, they'd be friendly and warm, but they're effectively big trouble because they say they're going to help you and you count on them and then they totally let you down. And they could leave somebody bleeding in the street because they had their head turned by something else and they just felt like chatting up with some cute girl, cute guy, etc. So you could see how that they wouldn't mean to be a problem for somebody else, but they are because of a big flaky streak. They would be perfectly pleasant and they'd actually be warm, but they'd be a disaster. Okay, so you can see how when you at the extremes you can put together some weird looking combinations. In general, when we think about conscientiousness, it's going to turn out that so many things that we would be associated with those genes would also be associated with character strengths that we would call fair, okay, responsible. Organized, responsible, fair, etc. And so that people would follow rules that would be both moral and practical and everything else under the sun. Now, that doesn't mean that we can simply tell a person's conscientiousness by how neat their desk is. So Adolf Hitler probably had a very neat desk. So, but we can see that Adolf, despite what is probably very high conscientiousness in that regard, in that narrow way, was also unbelievably disagreeable. So when you get extraordinary disagreeability in there, now we start getting distorted outcomes that don't fit easy parameters. You're disagreeable enough, and you're not, and you're conscientious. You're not what I would call a sociopath. You're something else. That's a flaming narcissist. OK, Okay, if we take the low conscientiousness out of the equation, we wind up with just what we would call a narcissist. And that person can be more dangerous than a sociopath, depending upon who they are and what the circumstances are. So very, very good question, and we wind up getting a little bit muddy in there, because as we move things around, like, well, what is, when I think of conscientiousness, I'm not thinking of it, and we use that word, we're not just thinking of it narrowly as how well someone does a narrow task. We're thinking a little bit more globally that one of the, quote, tasks in life is to be orderly and responsible in our relationships to other people, not just our own toenails, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that the mind that is concerned about, quote, doing things right isn't just concerned about doing things right with respect to their own toenails. They're also concerned about doing things right with respect to their customer or with respect to their friends. So, it starts to broaden itself out, but we can't narrowly determine someone's conscientiousness by simply looking at how clean their closet is.
Got it. Okay. I mean, my immediate thinking is, well, if someone is extremely introverted, would that mean that they really don't care so much about their, quote, village as much as, say, if they're extreme narcissists and they're also very, very introverted, that can be something that doesn't really lend itself to them thinking about anybody else as much. Or am I just pulling this directly? It's a paduma.
Extreme narcissist, right. Actually, extreme narcissist and very introverted would be sort of an odd-looking person, because they would be very quietly frustrated with the world, that the world wasn't bowing down to them. And so they would be, you would see, you know, anger out of them. And you would see the amount of anger that you would see would be related to, it would be related to how emotionally unstable they were. So people can be very narcissistic, highly conscientious, and actually be quite functional because they may be quite emotionally stable. So they may be angry quite a bit, and they may be irritated, and they may feel like suing people, and they might even do it. And they may be angling politically for a lot more because they feel like they're being shortchanged. And they may be bitter, but they may be quite functional because they have enough emotional stability that their true colors about just how distorted their vision is of what they've got coming to them are kept under reasonable wraps. Whereas a person that is inherently more naturally volatile emotionally, then their narcissism in this regard becomes much more observable. They will have explosions of rage. So a highly narcissistic person, i.e. highly disagreeable individual, will be more obvious to the world the more natural emotional instability that they have. So that these are how all these, you know, there's six major dials on this music board, and that's why it takes a little bit of experience thinking about these things to understand how these combinations can work. So if you have, for example, someone who's very disagreeable, but they are also very emotionally stable, they might be relatively introverted, very intelligent, and very conscientious, you might not really ever know what a bastard they are until you actually have to face them on a specific issue in your life and there's a dispute over what is fair, and they've got some power and they're going to treat you very unfairly. Okay, and you cannot reason with them because they have an extraordinary distortion about what's fair. And that's when you find out that you have a narcissistic SOB, you know, standing in your way. So you might not know it. They may work in your company and you're working side by side with them, but if you never have a run-in with them and if you have superficial contact with them, they may seem perfectly reasonable, okay, and not any not outside the bell curve relative to anybody else until you have a conflict with them, and then you find out, holy smokes, there is no reasoning with that SOB. So whereas if they were naturally more emotionally volatile, if they were, say, in the middle of the bell curve for emotional reactivity, they would have frequent blow-ups that, and their reputation would be far and wide that they're a problematic human.
Hmm.
All right.
All right. Excellent. Okay,
on,
next question.
What else we got?
Well, all right, this one is about jealousy. Dear Dr. Lyle, after observing various relationships, including my own, I've discovered jealousy, especially when a partner is in a one-on-one setting with someone of the opposite sex. And trust doesn't even seem like a factor in my jealousy. For example, my brother doesn't like when his girlfriend and I hang out. He's my brother, for goodness sakes, and his girlfriend shows nothing but signs of loyalty toward him. Another example is when my girlfriend hugged her little cousin, who's a 10-year-old girl, and I got jealous that she wasn't hugging me, which is completely ridiculous. And the last example could be when children become jealous or possessive over their toys being shared or given away to someone else. It seems that adults exhibit similar behavior when their lovers' affections are being shared or given to anyone else. Trust has very little correlation, if none at all, with whether a partner gets jealous of these examples. So what's going on? Is it a natural tendency to covet all of our possessions, including our lover's attention? Is it hidden trust issues? Or is it our brain's algorithms running the 1% change scenario, 1% chance that we could lose what we worked so tirelessly to gain and keep?
Yeah, very good thinking. They nailed it. They analyzed this correctly. So all of your relationships are sitting under a competitive matrix. And so if a relationship is valuable, you are looking for cues that it could be under threat. And jealousy is simply the cue that your nervous system comes up with to communicate to you, into some kind of executive function, that there is a threat that has been perceived. And so in the issue of, this person saying, he's my brother, for God's sake, obviously I would sleep with his girlfriend. Bullshit. It doesn't really matter what you would or wouldn't do. What matters is, over the course of human natural history, did anybody's brother ever, take liberties with his brother's girlfriend or wife? All the time. That would be a very high threat situation, because essentially by being close to the family, that girl, for example, already has a feel for the gene quality, already feels like the genes have been vetted pretty well, and now wants to see, as long as I'm here, let's see if I can do 4% better. She's already swimming in about the right territory for her. She wouldn't be in a relationship with brother number one. But now brother number one is, down at Home Depot, trying to get stuff to get the sprinklers working right. And brother number two is having a cup of coffee with his would-be sister-in-law, and they're chatting it up. So don't think that the would-be sister-in-law isn't looking over this brother, trying to think through, is he better or worse than the one that I'm with, and maybe I can upgrade. And don't think that the brother isn't thinking, not bad. Maybe I'll think about a little casual mating strategy or downright poach this mate. Now, the truth is that obviously there would be fireworks and bloody noses, potentially, but still it's opportunity. And that proximity breeds opportunity. So it would be absurd to think that in the natural history of humans, that opportunity has not been exploited. So it would be unwise for the organism to be asleep at the switch. Now, when it comes to the little cousin or hugging one person as opposed to the other, these have to do with a little inference that clearly sits inside of humans that I find kind of amusing. And, of course, I have it myself, so that makes it even more amusing. And that is this notion of, you meet some new people, and they've got a dog, and the dog comes over and sniffs your hand and licks it, and it's like, oh, wow, well, Jody doesn't like most people, so she really likes you. It's like, yeah, doesn't this dog have great judgment? So the notion is that little children and animals, a quote, have a sixth sense as to the quality of adult humans, and therefore they're a litmus test for your gene quality and your worthiness to be in the coalition. And so therefore if the dog chooses grandmother number one over grandmother number two, then grandmother number two is all bent out of shape because potentially, you know, she's losing status. And so in the same way, when little three-year-old niece hugs the friend in the purple, you know, sweatshirt that looks pretty today rather than her auntie, then this is all like trouble, right? Because maybe auntie's not as fancy or attractive, et cetera, and maybe that the village needs to look at this and determine why it is that she's second-class citizen relative to her friend, okay? So everybody is on guard against those kinds of inferences, and so the jealousy mechanism is telling you, look out, you're about to lose status. So it may not be that you're concerned about the status with that three-year-old niece. You're concerned about the inferences that other people will make in the village about the fact that the niece is picking your friend over you. So, yes, the person sized this up at the end with the whatever they said, that are we really on guard? Do we have algorithms in there that are tracking very small percentage chances of threats and activating essentially defense reactions against those? Yes, that is precisely what's happening. Good question. Excellent.
Excellent. All right. Okay. So, dear Dr. Lyle, how much abuse can our bodies take from working so much? I'm a waiter at a restaurant 7 days a week and a lab courier during the day. I'm married, have a 20-month-old son, and I'm in my late 20s. I'm wondering if it's normal to work this much and whether or not there are any negative long-term effects from this. I remember in one podcast you mentioned that our ancestors did a lot of long, hard labor during the day, which made them sleep well at night. So have human bodies evolved to be able to work so much for a long time? Could people generally work hard into their 30s, 40s, and 50s without pushing their bodies too much?
Yeah, they generally could. They could work quite hard. There's a lot to this question, and it's probably worth thinking some things through. One problem is repetitive motion injuries. So repetitive motion injuries would not have been consistent with a lot of the hard work that people would have done in the Stone Age. So that people can be literally typing and clicking a mouse, and if they're doing that for hours and hours on end, they can be doing some damage. And even though it's not quote, particularly hard in terms of the intensity of muscular contractions, the repetitive nature of that is an unnatural series of actions, and those can cause injuries that can be really problematic. Now, a waiter in a restaurant is probably going to be less susceptible to that. Those movements are going to be more consistent with human natural history. They're not going to be a bunch of little micro movements happening over and over again at odd angles. It's going to be much bigger muscular contractions and bigger sweeping motions, not going to be as much of a problem. Now, however, there can be lifting and twisting and with substantial weights on things that, you know, you could wind up with injuries that could be problematic under that regard. I would say this. We also have inherent weaknesses. And so you can wind up with injuries that can be pretty difficult for you if you're going to be a physical laborer for a lot of your life. And so anybody that is got some intelligence and has options, I would say don't plan on doing this a long time. It's one thing to wait tables at a nice restaurant for a few years because you're making, you know, $25 an hour, so maybe you can make $50,000 a year doing this and squirrel some of it away behind tips, and now the government doesn't know what it is, and so you're effectively making what somebody else is making $65,000 or $60,000 behind a desk somewhere. Still not a good idea. Okay, so it's a good idea that if you've got a brain, use it. And the modern environment affords us the opportunity to learn saleable skills where we don't have to be putting up with these physical burdens. Now, there are people that love their physical work. A lot of guys really like the feeling of accomplishment that comes with pounding a nail in the wall and, you know, doing constructing things and that sort of thing. I understand that. And I'm not going to talk them out of it if that's what they love to do, but I've seen a lot of those guys at 55 and potentially in trouble. And a common back injury at that point can devastate a career, and you really have nowhere to go, and you better hope you've got some net worth behind you. So the I would say in general, if this person's in their 20s or early 30s, and you know, you need to be doing something that you haven't done up to now, which is think about investing in a skill that gives you the option to not do what it is that you're doing and have a secure a future should we wind up in a, for goodness sakes, a car accident and you wind up with a back or neck injury and your physical labor is no longer a possibility. And so it's probably better sooner than later to get yourself in a much more secure position in the modern economy. Use the brain if you've got one.
Fantastic. All right.
All right.
Okay, we got time for one more question.
Incidentally, hold on. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, an addendum to that. It's not necessarily easy to think through how one would think through what one would learn to do. And it's easy to make mistakes here. And I probably discussed this at other times. The concept that what we love to do is very often sexual displays. So women like fashion design and interior design and et cetera. Men want to be, you know, they want to get into sports and work for ESPN or who knows what it is that they want to do. They want to be a martial arts teacher. Okay, so they have a love for it, or they want to play the guitar, and they want to perform, and they want to have a band. Okay, now listen. These are sexual displays, and therefore doing sexual displays for a living is the ultimate of double dipping. In other words, you're taking care of both survival needs and reproduction needs at the same time. The double dipping that goes on here is going to be problematic because the supply and demand function of a free market tells you that there's going to be a hell of a lot of people that are going to want to do this double dipping. So it means that the wages for something that is a double dipping, grandstanding, sexually attractive behavior pattern are generally going to be lousy and there's going to be no security in it. So this comes to my rule of thumb, which is that sexual displays make lousy careers. Now, they also make phenomenal careers. So if you're LeBron James or Jerry West, all the poor young people out there don't know Jerry West and what a phenomenal human being Jerry West is, i.e. Michael Jordan, Joe Montana, et cetera, yeah, or, I don't know, Christie Brinkley. So if you can pull it off, yeah. Nathan cueing everybody that he's much younger than I am. All right, so the point is that if you can pull it off or you think you can pull it off, that this is what I call behavior for your 20s. There's nothing wrong with taking your 20s and taking a flyer at it if you think you've got the talent and the push to possibly make a sexually display into a career, have at it. But there needs to be a time where we face reality, where we figure out that, you know, you're not going to be John Lennon. And if you're not going to be John Lennon, you may be pursuing a career behind a sexual display, and thinking that this is some lofty, grand thing that you're supposed to do with your life and not waste it. Well, that's a really good way to be broke for the rest of your life and to be embittered and actually not be very secure. So there's nothing at all that is how should I say it, but is it any embarrassment or any sellout of life to try to figure out how you can make a really good, comfortable living using your brain, doing something the market wants that's, you know, that is reasonably legitimate? This is outstanding. We're so fortunate to not have to go dig in the dirt or throw spears into wild animals to make a living. We can instead take part of our life's energy and work with, you know, find ourselves in a place and get ourselves in a position of power to put ourselves in places that we can choose to leave some company if it's a bunch of it's got a bad political situation that we can't stand, and spend our lives working with pleasant people that we like, doing something that is reasonable, reasonably productive, and feels perfectly fine doing, in exchange for a good financial security and the financial support that comes with that. That's called earning a living. And earning a living isn't supposed to be a sexual display that we get to be Elvis. A few people get to do that. Good for them. If it's not you, angle yourself towards something that looks like it's going to work in the economy that you find yourself in. And it helps to have what I call a license to steal. So much of the world's behavior now is organized into little guilds where people are legally required to have some kind of educational or training process that makes them allowed to do something. And it can be very useful to angle yourself towards one of those guilds to put yourself in a position for a secure, pleasant life. If you're not burning with some desire to be, you know, Katarina Witt. All right, let's move on.
Okay, one question though: who's Katarina Witt?
Oh my God! All right,
I'm sorry. I just
was an unbelievable bombshell in I think the 1980s that took the Olympics by storm. As a two-time world champion, women's figure skating champion out of East Germany. Okay.
Okay, cool. All right, we got time for one, Dr. Lyle?
All right, one more.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a 26-year-old Gemini. Just kidding. I'm a 26-year-old female. This is an actual part of the email.
Okay.
So she does have a sense of humor. I'm a 26-year-old female and soon-to-be graduate from an alternative medical program, naturopathic medicine. Mm-hmm. I'm frequently told that to be successful in my career, I will need to network with other professionals and, quote, put myself out there, quote, to attract patients. But personality-wise, I'm more of an introvert, and I'm less open to new experience, so this advice is a hard pill to swallow. I know I can't change, or I know I can't expect to change my personality to enjoy these necessary forays into the public eye. So can you offer some advice that will motivate me to participate in them or make them less miserable? How much public exposure do you think is necessary to have a fulfilling and successful career in medicine?
Well, we just got done talking about this problem. This is an individual that sought out a sexual display for a career. So naturopathic medicine is the smart chick's sexual display. And this is not going to be easy for the very reasons that I just talked about. So it's not the supply and demand function tells us that there's an awful lot more people out there that want to be naturopathic physicians than there are people that want to buy naturopathic, you know, advice. So that's a problem. Now, given that the person did this or is doing it or, you know, essentially going to complete this thing and is going to face this problem, then what we're going to need to do the marketing problem for your services is going to have to be solved by somebody. Now, it may be solved by you or it may be solved by an organization that you work for. So the problem is that at this point in time, I don't know that there's an organizational guild that has essentially got it set that if you're a naturopathic physician, which represents a great deal of learning and a lot of personal sacrifice and a lot of debt on most people's parts to go through this. They go through a similar process, certainly is competitive in terms of time, effort, energy, et cetera. So the average naturopathic physician, this person, I'm not making a comment about them at all, is that there's not a machine for them to walk into and start earning six figures in the way that the machine exists in medicine. And so this is dangerous behavior. And I'm always astonished when I see, you know, a class full of 80 young naturopathic doctors headed this direction. It's like, wow, you know, did you guys all think this through and pencil this out? And this is, you know, this is scary business. And the commitment that the person is making and the expense they're going to for this education is not trivial. So given that you are facing this, and now sounds like she's facing this daunting challenge now and realizing that people are saying, oh, you just got to get out there. It's like, whoa, how is that going to turn into the $80,000 a year or $120,000 a year income flow that I need to pay for office space, insurance, my student loan debt, and my life, okay, and a secretary, et cetera. In other words, how am I actually going to make this happen? Not easy. The first move that you could probably try to do is possibly work under somebody else that already has organized this thing and figured it out. A lot of times you can't, because nobody will hire you because they don't have enough business. They haven't solved the marketing problem well enough to need another individual on their staff. So this is this reminds me of life coaches. So a lot of people want to be a life coach, and they think, well, fine, I'll be a life coach. It's like, well, good luck to you, because the life coaches of the world that are part of the machine are called psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, and marriage and family therapists. Those people have licenses. They're integrated into the health system by insurance. And effectively, if you hold one of those licenses, you are essentially protected from the competitive environment, should you choose to be protected, by that entire marketing machinery, i.e. you have a license to steal, okay, is what my father used to call it. We call it license to steal because the free market operations have been suspended, and people are essentially benefiting from wages that are above what would take place under free market conditions. That is absolutely true of medicine. So medicine is the most astounding guild that exists in the United States, and the wages are very high relative to the benefits that are rendered the people, and actually the amount of skill and knowledge that is typically being brought to bear on the problems that people face when they walk into a doctor's office. Incidentally, that is being realized by the free market, by the rapid proliferation of nurse practitioners and physician assistants or physician associates, as we start finding out that a lot less education is perfectly adequate to solve the vast majority of many of these visits. Now, as we go on, so what do we do with this person's problem? Well, they either find somebody else that has solved the marketing problem and therefore can bring them an income flow, or they're going to have to solve it themselves. Now, the solution that you're going to, quote, just get out there and meet with the public and rub shoulders, et cetera, not probably likely to be the answer. So the answer today, in today's day and age, is probably going to be through the Internet. The Internet is by far the most successful marketing engine that you're probably going to be able to harness. The good news is your competitors will not be thinking that intelligently about this. This is a competitive problem, and it's quite frankly, to some degree, to a modest degree, it's you against your competitors in whatever area it is that you want to live. And so you're going to want to be smart about this. You need to be learning about internet marketing, et cetera. This is all about value proposition to a customer, that what it is on your website and your marketing campaign that can sell them to entice them to actually come and seek your services. It's all about what we call channel factors. In other words, how can we put them easily in a position to hear your message? So obviously, if you could afford $1 million worth of television advertising on your local cable channel, that I have no doubt that you would get quite a bit of business, but would you get enough to pay for the bill? No. But the question is there an it's literally an advertising scheme. This is a math problem. Every dollar of advertisement needs to draw in more than a dollar worth of business. So this is fundamentally not going to be an issue about you talking to little old ladies groups, although it won't hurt to have one good shtick where you introduce what you do, and with that, you know, a place where you could meet any given group and give them 20 minutes on what you do and hand out your cards, et cetera. But that's not going to be the way this is going to go. You're going to need to be directing a marketing campaign towards a wide enough catchment area. Don't go live out in the woods somewhere. You need to have a wide enough catchment area where it is that you can get your share of a market and have a marketing program that directs a sales funnel to you. So this is a lot to land on some 26-year-old sweet person that didn't know that they were aiming at a sexual display, that they honestly believe, no, I'm just a nice person that's altruistic and really wants to help people, i.e. you do, I understand this, and that I don't have any great faith in modern medicine, perfectly wise to have that kind of attitude, and I believe that there's the natural alternative way may have better options, and I wanted to dedicate my life to learning that and then sharing that. I understand. So this is all honorable and sweet and seemingly reasonable, but you are flying directly in the face of the most sophisticated, massive marketing engine that has gotten control of the legal system and the government, and your competitor is called the medical profession and the pharmaceutical industry. And so you are a pesky competitor, and unless you figure out a way to solve this marketing problem, it's going to be difficult. Now, it can be solved, and these people do solve it. So look at people that are successful at this and see what it is that they appear to be doing. Success leaves clues. And so we can look at that. I could have much more to say about this, but I'm not that knowledgeable. I've always thought that the way to sell alternative medicine was not generally in terms of general health and benefits and how we want to do things naturally, et cetera, but rather probably disease specific. So we would want to, people are listening to you behind a cost benefit proposition about a specific thing that you can help them with. So we need to tickle their ears and get their attention. If their problem is diabetes, if their problem is rheumatoid arthritis, whatever their problem is, we need to have something that we have confidence in, that we think that we can give them, and then we need to speak to them behind our approach, our natural approach that would be useful for that specific condition. That type of marketing strategy is, I think, likely to be the most effective way to go. All right.
Fantastic. All right.
And that person,
excellent,
by
Dr.
the way, Bell. Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, good. Yeah, that person, please feel free to write to me. My heart goes out to a young person like this that is, you know, worried about their career, worried about their future, not sure what to do. Please feel free to write to me at drdouglisle@yahoo.com, and I would be happy to chat with you a little bit more about some ideas that are not really relevant to be talking to a broad audience. Okay.
Yeah. Dr. Lyle, thank you as always. Great questions from our listeners. Love it. Oh,
all good?
We go. Can you hear me? Yep.
Yeah,
good.
I can hear you.
Excellent. All right. Well, Dr. Lyle, we will take care, and we will see you on the other next week and go over the rest of the questions that we have. We have a bunch of questions, so please keep sending them in. Really appreciate all these great questions from all the listeners.
Terrific. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.